You are Locked On the NFL, your daily NFL podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Well, hello, hello, hello. I am Matt Williamson. This is the Locked On NFL Podcast. I know we have a bunch of new listeners. It's great to have you. The word is spreading quickly on the Locked On Network. And a big reason why is because we've had some wonderful guests. And we have a new guest that I am super excited about. That's Doug Farrar. He writes for USA Today's Touchdown Wire. And he has a book out, The Genius of Desperation, that you all need to look into. Doug, it's great to have you, man. How are you?
Thanks, Matt. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the book. And you just got an awesome award, too, just a couple days ago, right? And I need to pull back the curtain. I got to be honest with you. I pre-ordered your book. It is sitting next to my bed. And my eyes are so bad, I can't read books right now. I need to go get reading glasses. I'm getting old. I started reading it with a magnifying glass, and I'm like, the hell with this. I'm just going to – hopefully it comes out on audio, or I'm going to get reading glasses, and then I'm going to tear through it this summer. But I can't wait to dig into it. I bought it months ago.
Well, thanks. Yesterday I found out the Professional Football Researchers Association, they have a Nelson Ross Award, and, you know, Michael McCambridge has won it, and Dan Daly's won it, a lot of really incredible researchers, and they gave me the 2008 Nelson Ross Award for Recent Achievement in Pro Football Research, which blew my mind. And the book is The Genius of Desperation, and it is a chronological schematic history of professional football, going back to 1920 to the formation of the league through guys like Clark Shaughnessy, who kind of spiffed up the T formation, into Paul Brown, of course, going into Lombardi and Landry, all the AFL innovators like Hank Stram and Sid Gillman, into the 70s and kind of the advent of the 3-4 defense and, you know, multiple defensive fronts, into today and, you know, the pistol formation, the Wildcat, certainly the increasing percentage of – well, just the increasing number of concepts from college that have found their way into the NFL. And I remember the first combine I went to was 2007. Scott McLuhan, who, of course, is one of the best personnel guys ever, he was the Niners GM at the time, and I asked him about, you know, all these college guys have different schemes and how do you adapt? And he said in 2007, within a few years, we're all going to have to adapt. And he was the first executive I had heard saying, you know, we're going to have to change our paradigms or things are not going to work for us. And other teams will get good players that, quote unquote, don't fit our systems and we'll get fired. That was so the book goes from, you know, and chronologically from 1920 to the present. And, you know, there have been a lot of great, you know, the games that changed the game by Jaworski and Cosell is certainly one. The Thinking Man's Guide to Pro Football by Dr. Z, which was last updated in 1984 and reads like it was written yesterday. And about 6 years ago, I had read a book on soccer tactics by an English author named Jonathan Wilson called Inverting the Pyramid. And it was a chronological, you know, schematic, tactical sort of biography of the sport. And I thought, well, there has to be something like that for professional football because there are so many books. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't. And I thought, okay, well, I guess write the book you want to read. And it took me about 3 years to do. Came out last September, and it's gone pretty well.
That's awesome. It's gone really well. And congratulations on the award. And it's amazing. It came out last September, but this game is changing so fast, like you alluded to. I wonder if you need to start writing another one.
I have actually thought about doing a new chapter.
Yeah, right.
2 or 3 years, I'm going to have to do an updated version.
Just keep adding the back of it, yeah.
You know, when I wrote it, the league was like 70% shotgun, and it feels like it's 80 now, and, you know, multiple fronts are even more multiple. Positionless football is even more positionless, and I know for sure there's never been a time where professional football has been so schematically diverse and so many coaches are looking for that next thing. And, you know, you have the Chiefs on one end who are doing all sorts of pre-snap motion, widening the field, you know, trying to replicate the collegiate boundary advantage. And then you have Sean McVay, who's running everything out of 11 personnel and, you know, nasty splits and doing everything after the snap. So you have, at this point in time, more schematic innovations or thefts or
good term,
because everything is stolen. I remember one part of the book, Joe Gibbs told Sports Illustrated in 2008 that he stole the counter tray from Tom Osborne at Nebraska. So everything is from somewhere else. But I think there are more new things in pro football than ever before, and I don't think that will change. And it makes the game incredibly fascinating to cover just from a conceptual standpoint.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but I bet, maybe not going back to the 20s, but the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, you probably did research and been like, I just saw the Patriots do that on Sunday. You know, like, sure. Yeah, I mean, again, they're not reinventing they're just putting window dressing on things that existed.
Yeah, I mean, and Bill Belichick would be the first to tell you that this is the case. And, you know, he's done some things. He will switch between, I don't believe in calling it 4-3 or 3-4 anymore, because I don't think there's any such thing, but he'll switch between one gap and two gap every couple years. He's run through, you know,
fullback,
two back, two back. And the Patriots dynasty started with kind of a heavy two back offense. And it certainly is that now. He's using a fullback, more than anyone else in the league, except for Kyle Shanahan. And when Kyle Shanahan had that great offense with Atlanta in 2016, Patrick DeMarco, I don't think he ever took a handoff. His job was to come out of the backfield and go wide, whether he was on the multi-receiver side of the field or he was the ex-ISO, just to take one linebacker and put him in a position of conflict. So, again, it is amazing to see how these things are done. I mean, in one part of the book, I talk about the opener of the 1950 season. Paul Brown had won all four All-American Football Conference championships with the Browns, and then they brought three teams, the Colts, the Browns, and Niners, up to the NFL. And Burt Bell, the commissioner at the time, said, okay, Browns, you think you're so hot, we'll put you up against the two-time NFL champion Philadelphia Eagles. And Greasy Neal, the Eagles coach, didn't really do the scouting he should have. He thought, you know, high school offense, blah, blah, blah. My guys are better. And Paul Brown did a whole bunch of things. He really, because he knew that there would be middle of the field open coverage, so he was doing all these slants and drags and things like that that Neal hadn't seen. But the most fascinating part is he knew that Neal's defensive linemen always lined up on the outside shoulder of the offensive tackle. So through the game, and this is something that Chip Kelly does now, through the game, he widened the offensive lineman's splits because he knew that the defensive line would not adapt to the inside shoulder when the splits were widened. So all of a sudden, you got Marion Motley at 270 pounds running through enforced widened line splits because the defense wouldn't adapt. And, you know, you bring that to the present day. If teams don't adapt now, you're in more trouble than ever.
And, no, by the way, that would translate to like a 310-pound running back today, exactly, running a 4-4, you know, screaming through the gaps.
Basically C.J. Anderson.
Nice. The book is Genius of Desperation. Congratulations on the award. Everyone needs to check that out for sure. The other thing you guys need to check out is something I've been talking about all week. It's my new favorite podcast. It's called That's Gold with Steve Heitner. You probably know Steve if you're a Seinfeld fan, which I assume most of you are. You better be. He played Kenny Bonya, who coined the term, That's Gold, Jerry. And on That's Gold, the podcast, Steve is joined by co-host Rich Johnson to talk about everything guys love. Sports betting, movies, comedy, food, drink, music, Vegas. And they come at you 5 days a week. It's like having a conversation at your buddies at a bar like we do here. And at their bar, a lot of famous guests show up and shoot the breeze. So check out That's Gold with Steve Heitner on Apple and Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And do Steve and I a favor and leave us a good review and hit the subscribe button on both podcasts, please. All right, Doug. Yesterday, Mike Sando was on. He's from your neck of the woods in the Pacific Northwest. He's the voter and the representative for the Seahawks in the Hall of Fame. And we had a really good conversation. If any of you missed it, check it out. Mostly about Hutchinson, to a lesser degree, Faneca, and basically versus Kevin Mawai. And I'm not trying to take anything from Mawai. I just thought he was clearly third on that list. And that turned into a Twitter conversation, which then turned into, hey, Matt, who's the best offensive lineman you've seen since you've been doing this, which is basically the last 20 years or so. And Hutchinson came to mind. He would be the guard, either him or Larry Allen. But yeah. My easy answer was Walter Jones. And I don't know if you know this, but the year I spent with the Browns, or if any of these listeners know this, one of my prime NFL responsibilities was I was in charge of the NFC West. So I watched every snap of NFC West tape when Jones and Pace and Ogden, for that matter, who's in the division, were all roaming like dinosaurs. I mean, just like roaming the earth and owning the earth. And it happened to Pace. It happened to Jones. Great pass rushers used to basically give up by halftime. Just realize that this is not a fruitful environment. I'm going to just kind of hang at the line of scrimmage, and if they run my way, I have a better chance. I'm not even going to challenge Walter. And to me, he's the best I've seen, I don't know, post-Munoz or the last 20 years or so. And I know you have some input on that.
Well, it's funny. After I left Bleacher Report and before I joined USA Today, I was doing freelance for a while, and I did a piece for The Athletic where I watched tape with Walter for
That's awesome.
A good hour. And we were talking about Seattle's current offensive line, which was kind of a mess because Tom Cable was coaching it. Got a lot better last year when Mike Solari was coaching it. But, yeah, when I look at offensive linemen and the effectiveness they bring, everything that goes into it, from pass blocking to run blocking to, to zone to power counter trap, I look at, like, can he do everything? And right now I have the article up. And I'm watching what he did to Mike Rucker in the 2005 NFC Championship game, and I'm pretty sure you know the block I'm talking about, where Sean Alexander takes a toss left,
and
Jones takes Rucker, who was, a one-time Pro Bowler, very good defensive end for a long time. He takes Rucker about 15 yards downfield. He's running faster than Alexander is, and at the end of the block, he takes Rucker, throws him to the ground, and deposits his helmet in Rucker's sort of abdomen, kind of like that Earl Campbell hit from a long time ago. And Walter in his peak. I remember one game against Atlanta. I think it was 2006, 2007. Patrick Kearney was one of the best pass rushers in the NFL. And within one quarter of that game, he had turned Kearney into a wheezing mess. So I would put Ogden in that, in that category. I would put Hutchinson in because as far as physical dominance, I don't think there was anyone else in his era who did what he did as well as he did it. But as far as root strength, agility, technique, I think Walter is the guy.
Yeah, it became non-competitive after a while. Me and my 12-year-old, it really was – you don't see that in sports. And it was really jaw-dropping to watch that snap after snap, play after play. And I urge you, because I retweeted that block that you're talking about last night because Ross Tucker put it out there, said something like it's his favorite block ever, and I can just picture my man Ross just loving this thing as it's going on. It's kind of like the Motley situation. Like, this is a huge man sprinting down the field, just toying with unbelievable human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and when I look at – I mean, when I got to – talk to Walter about technique. And we were talking a lot about Jermaine Ifedi and just the offensive line in general. And I've heard this from other great offensive linemen before. I think great offensive linemen take what I would call a defensive mentality to the position.
Yes. Aggressive, yeah.
And when I mean an offensive philosophy, it is even when you're run blocking, you're kind of it's sort of like the offensive version of a mush rush where you're like, well, I want to wait and see what he does. Walter told me over and over and over in that film session, you have to set the tone. You have to get your arms out. You have to stab with your hands. You have to put that guy where you want him and then get him out of the way. And I think, there are offensive linemen who do that with maybe improper technique or underdeveloped technique, and they're not quite there yet. And I think with Walter, and he was a JUCO guy before he was at Florida State, it took him a while to get there. But I remember hearing a story that Howard Mudd, who was Seattle's line coach the year Walter was draft eligible, they were talking about different guys, and Howard kind of stood on the table and said, look, this is the guy, and if you don't draft him, I'm going to do something nasty to you. And it was good for the Seahawks that they did. But, what Walter really wanted to impart that, and he is still in Seattle, and he works with the Seahawks offensive linemen as kind of a consultant. And he will tell those guys over and over and over, you have to be, I mean, it's the old Bill Walsh thing, throw the first punch. That's, you know, all the way through finding the winning edge. That's what he says.
Sure.
Throw the first punch. Be the first guy. Be the bully on the block. And Walter was that. And that particular, I mean, it's a combination of technique and mindset that he brought to the game. And I would put Ogden in the same category for sure. I would put Orlando Pace in that category. And maybe it's just because I've lived in Seattle for so long, I've watched Walter more than most, that he stands out as the guy who...
He would be my pick.
Just dominated his position at a level we've rarely seen.
Yeah, and maybe it's because of that area of the country, no offense to your neck of the woods, but he didn't get the notoriety in his heyday like the best players in the league would. I mean, there was no Pro Football Focus. You know, like, everyone knew he was great, but I don't think people realized that this might be the best guy that ever did it.
Certainly, well, 2005, when Sean Alexander won the MVP, I was, you know, it was pre-Twitter, but I was thinking, well, okay, right team, wrong guy. Walter Jones should have been the MVP.
Point. Right. Very good point.
He was the best player in the league that year by a crushingly wide margin.
Yeah. I mean, he was the Aaron Donald of the offensive line, you know.
Pretty much.
Yeah, exactly.
And actually, that's a good comparison because, again, going back to what Walter's told me, when he was a player, he thought like Aaron Donald thinks. He was not a passive offensive lineman. And if you look at the greatest offensive linemen throughout history, none of those guys are passive. Now, they get in their sets and they know how to catch and wait when they're pass blocking, if that's what they're directed to do in scheme.
They can be patient, but yeah.
Generally speaking, certainly in run blocking and depending on the scheme, you know, if they're running a zone slide or whatever, I'm going to take my guy, I'm going to get my hands on him, and I'm going to do something mean. Mm-hmm. And that's the mindset.
Yeah, and those guys don't grow in trees, obviously. Yeah. We'll be back in a minute. I want to talk a little bit of Flacco. We've talked that up, obviously, all week. But also a couple prospects, too. I mean, Doug is all over a handful of these prospects, and we'll get into it even more as the draft season rolls along. We'll be back here in a minute. All right, we are back. And briefly, I want to get your thoughts on Flacco to Denver. I was very meh about it originally, and now I understand it better. I don't know that he's the answer. I don't know that he's much better than Keenum, but I do think he fits more what they want to do in a Shanahan-like system, and he's had his best success in such a system, so I guess I get it.
I don't.
Yeah, I mean, I know. I don't think he's good.
Well, I did a tape on Flacco back when I was at Bleacher Report before the 2018 season because they drafted Lamar, and I was positing, should they put Jackson in now and just move on from Flacco, even though the cap hit was ridiculous because they signed him to a horrible contract for them.
The worst contract ever.
And when I watched Flacco, because he's always been, I mean, he's a gangly quarterback, and it's funny because we're talking about Kyler Murray's too short. Kyler Murray's too short. The number of overly tall quarterbacks who fail in the NFL, and I'm not saying Flacco failed. He had a good run for a while, but he hasn't thrown for over 20 touchdowns in a season since 2014. Mm-hmm. He hasn't played in everyone's like, well, Flacco's playoff resume. He hasn't played in a playoff game since January of 2015.
Right.
And when we talk about, you know, everyone's saying, well, Flacco is the prototype. That's what they want him because he looks the part. And everyone's bashing Kyler Murray because he's 5'9", and there's absolutely no way a guy 5'9 can play football in the NFL. And you know this because you've been a scout, and you've been in those rooms, and you've talked about these quarterbacks.
I recruited Joe to Pitt. That's my claim to fame. I found him at Audubon High School.
Yeah.
I watched him when he was 16.
Mike Cantor was one of his teachers, by the way.
Oh, no kidding. I didn't know that.
Yeah, so there's our 6 degrees of separation. But you know this, Matt. When you look at tall quarterbacks, you look at what I call the moving parts, the things they have to assemble, the mechanics they have to go through with the extra inches on the arms, the extra inches on the legs, the dropbacks that are not as seamless for a 6'6" guy as it would be if he was 6'2" or even 5'10".
It's like those inflatable things in front of car dealerships that are all over the place.
Pretty much. And there is an advantage to having a compact frame when you're taking a three-step drop. And I just did a tape piece on Kyler Murray that went up this morning.
Cool.
And there were a couple of just bang on. I focused on the Alabama game because that was the best defense and the most pro-similar defense he's faced. Because otherwise it was a bunch of Big 12 where it's just like, okay, 54 to 51. Yeah, mm-hmm. Here we go. There were a couple of times where he took like a two-step drop and read his guy, and it was, you know, intermediate to deep passes. And he's making these bang-on throws because he doesn't have to assemble his body into something resembling mechanics. You watch – I would much rather have Kyler Murray than Mike Glennon. And I think at this point in his career, Flacco mechanically is more in – you know, he's a gangly guy. He's not what I would call a supple thrower. He – you know, so the mechanics are a problem. The accuracy is a problem. What I discovered that really concerned me when I watched the tape and you know, four or five games was the reads. He doesn't read well.
No, he doesn't.
And that's a real problem. And you can, okay, he's in a system that works for him, has worked for him in the past. You know, I don't know how much I put into that. I know that Case Keenum in 2017 was in a system that was extremely favorable for him. And he had a season that was exceptional. He gets into Denver and he kind of returns to his level because it wasn't schemed open. And I think Flacco's a guy who needs things at this point in his career. He's a guy who needs things schemed open for him, schemed open obviously for him. I wouldn't put him in a top 25 of NFL quarterbacks. I think at this point he's basically low starter or high backup material. And I think the Ravens told you everything they need to know when they, because they had a choice. They could have gone with Flacco through 2018. And yes, Flacco got hurt, but there was a performative aspect to the switch to Lamar to change that offense to what Lamar can do and to basically say, yeah, we're done. And when you look at just the statistical stuff between Keenum and Flacco, it's very similar. Flacco actually projects out worse if you go over a four-year space of time. And so I guess Elway's hoping that he can, you know, replicate the Peyton Manning thing. To me, it's one more mistake in a long history of Elway mistakes with quarterbacks. And you have to wonder, I mean, if he hadn't beaten the Seahawks to the punch, because the Seahawks and the Broncos were the two teams desperately trying to get Manning, which was before Seattle drafted Russell Wilson. You know, if they don't get Manning, you have to wonder if Elway has a job. And I don't think this will work well for them at all.
Yeah, I definitely hear what you're saying. And to take it a step further, you talked about the tall, gangly quarterbacks. I don't think Elway's gotten that memo. I mean, Osweiler, Lynch, now Flacco. I mean, they're three of the, five or six, over 6 foot six guys in the league the last couple of years. And yeah, the Manning thing's great, but what if he doesn't pick him? And the other thing is the luckiest thing that happened to him was Houston offered Osweiler a little bit more than Denver did. They tried to keep him. They did everything they could, and they just lost that battle. And they won the Manning battle. But what if those two things go opposite? I mean, well, he definitely don't have a job.
And then he brings Osweiler back for that year of quarterback purgatory where they had Lynch, Simeon, and Osweiler. And it was like, if you Frankenstein those three guys together, you might have a functional quarterback between them. But, I mean, I watched tape, and Paxton Lynch is a good guy. I watched tape with Lynch like 2 days before he was drafted. And we focused on the Memphis game because that was the game where he just blew up. And even in that game, I'm watching him like boot left, and there are two open guys right in front of him. And he doesn't see them. And you ask these things tactfully, but you're like, well, what are you reading? And he wasn't really sure. And, you know, we all have our sort of lists of things that we think are important with quarterbacks. I mean, for me, accuracy is number one. 1A is diagnostic ability. If I don't see that, I run screaming away from that guy. And when I look at a Kyler Murray, when I look at a Haskins, when I look at a Drew Locke, who's improved exponentially in this, and that guy's got a just plus-plus arm.
I want to talk about him next, actually. But, yeah,
When I see that, if I see diagnostic ability, I think, okay, now we have something to build on. If the diagnostic ability is sort of undercut by mechanical issues, depends on what they are, can be fixable to a degree. But if the guy can't read the field – why are you bothering? And Flacco's read problems, they go back all the way through his career. And, you know, we're going on that one postseason where he had 11 touchdowns and no interceptions, and that's great. But when you look at a guy who's been in the league as long as he has and you see obvious reading issues, and it sounds like you agree with me on this, at 34, he's not going to fix that.
No. And the other thing, that the big misconception with him is, yes, he has a strong arm. I mean, he can throw the ball hard. But he is no longer a downfield aggressive passer. Everyone remembers all the deep pass interference, Torrey Smith, all those bombs they threw. I mean, last year, Alvin Kamara averaged more yards per rush than Flacco did per throw. I mean, he's become conservative. Once he doesn't want to get hit, I don't like his pocket presence. There isn't the aggression. There's very little playmaking ability. I assume you agree on those things too.
Well, you go back to the 2017 season. I mean, Mike Wallace, I think, should have sued him. Wallace was actually in
he did
that
his job,
if you watched Wallace's routes, I would think this is a top 20 receiver. You isolate. Greg Cosell told me this years ago. You have to isolate the guy out of the offense. And I would isolate Wallace, and I would think, man, he's running a bang-on route. This is really good stuff. And then Flacco would you'd throw a helium ball, and Wallace would have to slow down, and, you know, 14 Steeler defenders would be around him, and, Mike Wallace can't catch the ball.
Right. Well, no wonder he can't catch the
ball. And that's another – I mean, Flacco, if the ball's going past 10 yards, he has real trouble with timing. Anticipation, throwing your guy open is the parlance. He doesn't do that. So to me, this is the long, very long story short. It's one more quarterback mistake by the Broncos. They've now had this hellish cap situation. They were talking about trading Chris Harris, which would be monumentally stupid. Now they're not going to, keep Brandon Marshall, which is also monumentally stupid. And you just have to wonder what they're thinking.
Yeah. I said this for the day the trade happened, that this is a quietly dysfunctional unit and franchise more than people realize. It's funny you do that isolate the wide receiver comment. I do that all the time around here. Everyone's talking about Antonio Brown and, he's losing a step. He doesn't put up the same numbers. Yeah. I'm like, if you watch 84 all year, he should be mad at Ben because, oh my God, is he as good as ever? And especially early in the year, Ben could not get him the football. It was insane. Yeah. Anyway, I just had to get that off my chest. Last thing I wanted to bring up to you is, again, I'm not big on this Denver move. Don't get me wrong. But I could understand it a little if you go into the season with Flacco and Locke. I don't think that's what they're going to do. I think they're going to try to win 8 or 9 games, get into the wild card, save their job, draft a corner or a receiver or something. But what is your thoughts on Locke? And then we'll wrap this up.
I like Locke a lot. I like how he's improved his mechanical efficiency. I think if I were to start last season, I would have made a Jay Cutler comparison. Now I think more Matthew Stafford,
which
is more workable. I love the arm. I love the mobility because watching Russell Wilson since his first rookie minicamp, it was always impressive to me how he understood how to throw on the run. You square your shoulders to the target. You lock your eyes at a certain point. You have your body primed for success. I think Locke does that. So he's a mobile guy with a tremendous arm, made a lot of accurate throws. He was a guy who was let down by a ton of drops. I don't know, have the stats yet, but seemed like a ton of drops by his receivers, and that could be recency bias, but I think he was let down by his guys a lot of the time. I think he's a... As far as overall talent in quarterback comparisons to previous years, probably a high second round guy, which means he's a quarterback who's going to go top 10.
Right.
I think he has, I wouldn't put him in the same realm as Haskins or Murray. And Murray is my QB1. I'm a tremendous fan. And I know a little bit about short quarterbacks, so I don't have a problem with it.
Daniel Jones is the guy I really don't see as a first round player.
You know, there are times when he looks like Philip Rivers, and there are times when he just, I'm not sure what's going on.
Okay. That's a bigger story for another day, but I don't know.
He's a developmental guy.
Okay.
I think you have Haskins, you have Murray, you have Locke. Those are the three guys that stand out to me. And Locke, if you put him in an Air Coryell Greatest Show based thing where it's pretty simple three-digit stuff and you can just wing it in favorable route combinations, I think it's going to be great. But those are the three guys to me who don't need a year.
Okay.
And, you know, Locke, I think Haskins and Murray are my, you know, it's Murray and Haskins is one. Locke's probably my 1A, and the more tape I watched of him, the more I liked him. You know, he's a big guy with a big arm, so of course he's going to get overdrafted, but, you know, I think he's got to
understand it.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Doug, this was awesome. This was the quickest half hour in a long time. It was a blast. Everyone needs to check out The Genius of Desperation. Check out Doug's columns on the USA Today Touchdown Wire. It's really good stuff. He's pumping out a lot of content there. And where can they follow you on Twitter?
NFL underscore Doug Farrar, F-A-R-R-A-R, and I am trying not to tweet about politics too much, so it's mostly football.
Okay.
But sometimes you just can't help yourself.
I understand, man. Dude, this was a blast. Thanks so much.
All right, take care.